Welcome to the Bastianland Podcast's Niche Explorer series, where each week I'll be welcoming a new guest to talk about their own personal corner of the tabletop gaming world. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by a man who has defrosted the landscape of miniature wargames, a ludologician who compels you to thaw out your old miniature collection and throw them into battle one more time, the artificer of games such as Frostgrave, Rangers of Shadowdeep, and Oathmark. Welcome to Joseph McCullough. Hi.
Thank you. I
how are you?
Most of those words meant, but yeah.
I thought I could get away with using, I'm amazed that I managed to say it correctly, but ludologician.
Yeah. you got me on that one. I got no idea.
I don't think it's a real word.
I feel better.
So yeah, I mean, obviously, as you well know, if you just make up your own words, then you can pronounce them any way that you want.
That is true. Just do it with confidence.
That's it. So for those people who are listening to this and that are perhaps more familiar with role-playing games, would you mind just giving a little brief introduction to where they may have heard of your games, perhaps?
Yeah, I guess. So I wrote Frostgrave, or Frostgrave came out 5 years ago, and it really was an attempt to see if I could kind of bring a role-playing flavor to a tabletop miniature game. So it's very much a game about wizards and throwing spells around and gathering up treasure, as opposed to just directly killing each other, as is true in most role-playing games. And that was published by Osprey Publishing. And then a few years later, I self-published a game called Rangers of Shadowdeep, which uses the same core rule system, but changes things to be a cooperative or solo endeavor. And it was, again, kind of, I wanted to see if I could push tabletop wargaming just that one step closer to role-playing. And I thought, actually, kind of cooperative is the main thing that's missing. So I self-published that, and that's now published in a deluxe edition by Modiphius. So those are the big ones that perhaps role-players might have come across.
Yeah, definitely.
In their travels.
And I think... So without going too far into my own experience with Frostgrave, yeah. I think I was first introduced to the book. I think I was first showed the book by Paolo Greco of Lost Pages Publishing, who published Into the Odd for me. I remember him showing it me at a convention, and I remember flicking through it and thinking, oh, this is like a cool looking RPG. And I remember thinking, oh, they're using like miniatures for the images. That's unusual, because I just assumed it was an RPG because, you know, we're RPG guys. And then when I realized it was a skirmish game, I think even at a glance, it's easy to see the sort of, there are bits of it that read almost like more like a role-playing game. So what is your personal history in terms of whether you started out with RPGs or with war games?
Well, I guess first off, I guess I go so far back that, so I started kind of gaming in the mid 80s. And at that time, the distinction between war games and role-playing wasn't near as great as it is now. You know, most companies that did one also did the other. And I mean, really, all of role-playing grows out of war gaming anyway. I guess I started when I was about 10, 8, 9 or 10. I can't remember exactly. And I brought home a copy of the D&D Red Box from a yard sale or something, and couldn't figure it out, you know, as you wouldn't really expect an 8 or 9 year old on their own to be able to really understand it. But I didn't care. You know, I knew that there were monsters in it, and I knew there were spells in it, and I knew there was stuff you could buy with gold pieces in it. So I did my best to play it anyway. And then my father, who I guess saw me struggling with that, did what is, I now realize, quite an amazing thing. And he went out and he bought a copy of MERP, the Middle Earth role playing, because he was a big Lord of the Rings fan. And he read that, and he became my first game master. And not only is that unusual, but I think it's especially unusual for the time, because you got to remember that in the mid 80s, role playing had a just terrible reputation, and my father is a Catholic teacher, so you know, that seems really unlikely, but luckily he's a very, very open-minded Catholic teacher, and And yeah, became my first game master and guided me through and really continued to game master for me and my friends for 3 or 4 years until he could kind of hand it off to us and let us run with it.
And that's interesting because I think that's, like you say, at the time, I think that would have been extremely uncommon.
Yeah.
But I think nowadays, if we're thinking about sort of kids today who are like 10 years old,
right?
A lot of the parents of those kids may have dipped into role-playing games or war games in the past. So I bet today it's a lot more common for that sort of thing to happen where the parents are the parents are the first GMs.
Yeah. Well, my oldest kid is 6, so I've got a few more years, but I'm waiting in the wings.
I always see so many like threads on Reddit and on forums where people are talking about, it's like when they've just had a child and it's like they're waiting for the right time.
Yeah, exactly.
And I see people saying like, oh yeah, I've got a 3-year-old daughter. What could I run for? And
the interesting thing about the story though, is of course that in some ways that thinking's backwards. Cause it's not like, cause my father wasn't obviously waiting for me to become a gamer so that he could introduce, you know, his hobby to me.
Yeah,
it was
exactly.
He saw an interest I had and then, you know, took it upon himself to understand it and encourage me in that way. So,
yeah.
So while I intend to give them the shot at role playing, I got to remember not to push it on them either if they don't want
it. That's it, yeah. So we did speak about this briefly before the recording. So you grew up obviously in the US.
Yes.
And I obviously grew up in the UK, and we were saying it's interesting that it seems very common in the US for people to get their start with role-playing games, especially sort of D&D in the 80s. Was it moving to the UK that got you interested in war games in a big way?
Yes and no. So like I said, for me growing up, wargaming and role-playing were kind of just two aspects of the same kind of hobby. And I did play a lot of war games in the U.S., although a lot of those were of kind of the older style, you know, hex-based and counters as opposed to miniatures. So games like Battletech or Car Wars and my all-time favorite Silent Death, a space fighter game.
Cool.
But I did get into miniatures. So, you know, I used to occasionally buy White Dwarf in the U.S., which was really hard to come by, but you know, you could get it at your specialty shops. And again, like the text made almost no sense to me because I didn't know what games they were talking about. And the kind of Britishness of it was extremely high in those days. And so I just couldn't follow most of it. But, you know, it didn't matter because I was looking at all these cool miniatures and stuff. And I had to special order, but I got a box of the original Plastic Imperial Guard from Games Workshop. And my friend got the original Plastic Space Marines, and we swapped around, and so we ended up playing miniatures games even though we didn't have the rules, or we just kind of made up the rules, or we took fragments of the rules that we could find in White Dwarf and used them. And then occasionally we did later dabble in some war games, but I think really, yeah, I was a role player and I liked painting miniatures to go along with the role playing. And then when I moved to the UK, obviously I left all my role-playing game buddies behind. And so for a while, all I could do was paint miniatures because it was the only kind of solo aspect of the hobby I did. And then slowly realized I had enough miniatures that I could be wargaming more, and there was a lot more wargaming going on. There's always conventions in the UK wherever you are you can go to. Well, not at the moment, but in general, you know, in a given year, there's dozens and dozens of little wargaming conventions.
Yeah.
So that was the scene. That was the easy scene to be a part of. So it just encouraged me in that direction. And then I went to work for Osprey, which has always had a close connection with historical wargaming. And I was there through the rise of Osprey Games, so which was mostly war games for most of its history. So yeah, I mean, in the sense that if I had to say, kind of break my gaming life in half, the first half was more role playing and the second half has been more wargaming. But yeah, like I said, I've always seen them as part of the same thing. In fact,
yeah,
it's almost like I kind of think of the distinction being more about state of mind than it is rules. So for me, I think of Rangers of Shadow Deep as a role-playing game. Even though you have to have miniatures and you have to set up the table, I am in the head of my ranger. That is my character. You know, I am telling the story through this miniature.
Definitely.
Whereas, you know, War Game is about, I am kind of this general over here commanding either the troops or the units or whatever to do it. But I'm not there in the same kind of way, you know?
Yeah, I think with Rangers of Shadowdeep, from what I've seen of it, I think you could have, if you put RPG on the cover, I don't think anybody would have batted an eyelid when it came to reading through right. it. I think you could have easily pitched it. I mean, obviously, it's being like it presents as a war game, and I think it does fill that niche as well. But it is really interesting in that I think you could have. I think if you'd called it a role playing game, I don't think anybody would have said, "Well, actually, this is technically more of a war game." I think it's.
I'm sure somebody.
Oh, would have yeah. as soon as the words left my mouth, I thought, "Actually, no, I can see
that,
this."
That doesn't sound like gaming.
But yeah, I think you would have got exactly the same amount of people as I'm sure there are people who would insist that, say, Frostgrave is more of a role playing game because you have a wizard character. So it is interesting that blurry patch in the middle that, like you say, used to be much more of the mainstream is really interesting to me. I've been looking back over. I mean, did you have much experience with the old Games Workshop games? So like your sort of Rogue Traders or Realm of Chaos things.
Well, I mean, so I got Rogue Trader, although not until Warhammer was probably on second or even third edition. I was able to go back and get a book. And you know, it still kind of remains my favorite iteration of 40K because it is so much more role-playing. And again, you can make the argument either way as to what it is. I think it calls itself role-playing, but I'm not sure.
It's my holy grail. I need to find myself a copy because it's something I definitely need to have a physical copy. I'll definitely look if I see one.
Yeah, they reprinted it. I think maybe you can only get it if you actually like go to Games Workshop.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, it was just at Warhammer World. So I have a man in Nottingham who I have.
I got a guy,
a guy who will be on this podcast in a few episodes. So I'll let him explain that. But yeah, I've got a guy in Nottingham who's looking out for, and he knows that as soon as he sees that Rogue Trader, he needs to grab me a copy and post it to me, and I'll pay him back.
Right, I love that line because. Probably my favorite example is, you know, if you kind of follow the story of Pinnacle Entertainment. And so they put out Deadlands, which is clearly a role-playing game. And then they put out Great Rail Wars, which takes the setting and makes what is clearly a war game. And then they take the rules from Great Rail Wars and make Savage Worlds, which calls itself a role-playing game, but is using the rules from a war game and can be used for a war game. So
yeah,
what is it? You know,
I think one of my long-term, I always have a list of stupid ideas that I want to do for game designs. And one that it's probably been on this list since I was about 10 years old, because I think I was thinking about this when I was playing Warhammer Fantasy Battles back when I first got into it, is whether you could just make a role-playing game using just the light battlefield mechanics from Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay. And it's kind of just a silly thought experiment, but I think it goes to show how much of that difference is about presentation more than mechanics. I think,
you know, you can still pull the combat system out of, say, Pathfinder and play it as a war game.
Absolutely.
You know, you don't have to role play it.
And I think like I remember seeing on I can't remember if this was on a forum or on Discord or something like that, somebody was asking, will there ever be a like a Frostgrave or Rangers of Shadowdeep RPG, and saying, oh, that'd be really cool. And you know, well, there's an idea for you. But also, I almost wanted to reply and say, like, well, look, you've got Rangers of the Shadowdeep. Like, what more do you need, really? I mean, you could take either of those books and tweak the way they're presented, and I think make a perfectly passable role-playing game.
Yeah, and I have thought about it in the more for Frostgrave, because it is perhaps farther away from a role-playing game. But I think the one thing that kind of gives me pause is the one key difference between writing a war game and writing a role-playing game for me is when I wrote Frostgrave, I tried to keep the setting quite vague.
Yes.
So, you know, you're in this frozen magical city, this ruins, but there's not a lot of description of what that actually looks like. There's not a lot of breakdown about regions. There's no map. And that was very intentional because I wanted players to be free to imagine it any way they wanted, because they are going to try to recreate that on a table.
Definitely.
You know, they've got to use their own terrain, and they may not have specific terrain that looks like that, and they may not be able to make it. So, you know, whereas in role-playing, since you're using a theater of the mind, you can describe it any way you want, and everybody can build that for free. when you're wargaming, they have to, like, actually build it. So, but whereas when you play a role-playing game, especially now, most people are expecting quite a lot of background material for your setting.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I actually looked this morning because I thought I'll just check how long is this. It's just the foreword of Frostgrave. The introduction is that's really the only bit of like outright setting.
Yeah, I mean, you got little bits of fluff kind of in monster descriptions. And
yeah,
things,
absolutely. But they're all because they're all like attached to a bit of the actual game. I mean, this is what I sort of really try to do with my games is I try to have a real hardline approach to it and say like, right, I'm not gonna have anything that isn't attached to some part of the game. And I checked and your intro is like 250 words, I think, or thereabouts.
250 solid gold words.
Well, that's it. It's I think what's good about Frostgrave is it's once you've read that, you kind of only need to remember Frost and Grave, like,
yeah.
Like that's almost the setting. Like, okay, it's cold and there's exactly. ruins and there's undead and there's demons. And to me that for a role-playing game, I think that presents more opportunity and gets me more excited about running a game than if you'd say written a huge timeline of like, right, here is exactly what happened in the last 1,000 years of Felstad. And here's, you know, here are the main factions and it's like a big, huge book full of fluff. Like some people do like that, and I think there's definitely in a role-playing game it can help with new players to have something like that to latch onto. But I think doing it that sort of implied setting, even things like the fact that the cheapest well not quite the cheapest but almost the cheapest type of soldier you can buy is called a thug, and then you've got another one called a treasure hunter, and it tells you something about the world that there are treasure hunters and there are thugs that want to come and work for these wizards. It doesn't give you the answer, but it gives you just enough of a question that you have to think, well, why? In fact, this is, I'm not going to ask you for an explanation about this because I don't want the official explanation, but in the second edition of Frostgrave, I've seen one of the changes is that previously you had to pay to hire all of your soldiers, but now you can get like the cheapest lot of soldiers for free. So you can get, so if you need to sort of fill out your warband with thugs or warhands, you can get enough warhands to like fill out your numbers up to 10. And I understand the game reason behind that. Absolutely. And it to do with sort of not ending up in a too dire of a situation where you can't fill out your warband. But I also like that it suggests, I can't help but try and think of like fictional reasons why that would be the case. So like, I kind of think that these thugs are like, they're agreeing to help this wizard for free, but maybe they're secretly hoping that the wizard's going to die and they can loot the body, or they're always looking for like a better job on the side.
It's just kind of like, hey, who wants to go look for treasure?
You know? Yeah, they're working for exposure. That's the thing. And
exactly.
I think it's, sometimes having less can do more for the setting. But in terms of Frostgrave, when I was looking through it, I'm always interested to look at what's not in a game, because I think war games especially, I'm more familiar with role-playing games these days, but for war games, that there's certain things that I think people expect to be in the game. So I noticed that sort of there was no morale system really. And the random monsters that sort of pop up in there from time to time and just appear on the battle on the edge of the battlefield. I know that there's some weighting in terms of which some monsters are more likely than others to appear, but sometimes you will just get a terrifying monster with no real sense of balance, and I don't at all mean that in a bad way. So it feels like some of those things were left out as sort of deliberate decisions. Was there anything that you removed from Frostgrave that you think was particularly impactful in that you either removed it or omitted it entirely?
My favorite omission is that there are no races in the game, or species, or whatever.
Yes,
you want. You know, there's no elves, there's no dwarves, except that their omission isn't because the world doesn't contain them. Specifically, the omission is because I didn't want to give them any specific stats.
Sure.
For two reasons. One, a very game mechanical reason, in that it just becomes so much harder to balance everything as soon as you do that.
Yeah.
And I didn't believe anything is really gained by that. You know, in fact, I thought it was detractful, because by getting rid of it, you can now play whatever race you want and I don't have to write rules for it. And you don't have to worry about, you know, if you want to play dwarves in most war games, you have to accept that they're slow.
Mm.
And in some games, that's actually a real problem. You know, in Frostgrave, that would be a real problem.
Yeah.
Because, you know, speed is quite important, because it's about getting to the treasure and getting away with it. And as soon as you, you know, chop off somebody's movement, you just gave them a huge disadvantage. And I wanted people to be able to play dwarves if they wanted to without feel like they were taking a penalty, you know?
Yeah.
And in the same way, I wanted people to play elves because they really like elven miniatures, or they really like the idea of playing elves, and not because elves are the best, therefore I'm going to play elves, you know? So that's my favorite addition, because I think it really is addition by subtraction. It just opens up so much more freedom, and it makes the game actually better balanced by not being in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, I was saying, I do also like that I left out morale, and that's probably the one that actually has gotten the most comments, or at least it did right at the beginning.
Hmm.
I think once people play it a couple of times, they realize Frostgrave has such a heavy campaign element that, you know, at a certain point you realize during the game, it is no longer worth me attempting to get that treasure or to do whatever. I'm just going to leave.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, the warband doesn't need morale, because the player does have it.
Yeah, 100%. I think it's always better to, if you can make the players scared, you don't need to make the character mechanically scared. Like,
it's just really frustrating if, like, your warband decides to run away from the table when you're having fun playing.
You know? Oh yeah, definitely.
Oh, the game's over.
I think the what you said about not having sort of statistics in there for, like, having an orcish warband or like an elf warband, links back to role-playing games quite nicely, because I think that was one of those things where it seemed like such an obvious thing to put in the game. Like, obviously working through the editions of D&D to begin with, like, your dwarf was just, that was it. You were a dwarf. And that was your class.
Yeah.
And then obviously they started to have classes and that they could be. And then by third edition, it was sort of a free for all. Any race can be any class. But there's an interesting blog post about it somewhere, which I'll put in the notes, about how it moves into that build mentality as well, where if you're playing, if you really want to play a barbarian in the game and you're really excited about the idea of playing a barbarian, and then, you know, say that the barbarian in this game, they like to have a high strength score and they like to have lots of hit points, and then there's also a player race that has +2 to strength and +2 to hit points.
Exactly.
Like, even if you're picking it for mechanical reasons, and it can be fun to make those little combos line up, and it can be kind of satisfying from a game point of view. But then what you end up with is a situation where every barbarian is an ogre or whatever that race is.
Yeah.
And like I want to have a world where you can have an elf barbarian or a gnome barbarian. And again, it raises questions, and you can think, well, okay, so what does an elf barbarian look like? And it can make that character interesting, even if they're kind of mechanically identical to the orc barbarian.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in a role-playing game where so much of it happens outside of the rules.
Yes.
I think having that kind of freedom is really good.
Yeah, I mean, it is a legacy thing, isn't it? It grows out of wargaming, so everything had to be balanced in certain senses, and that's really not true anymore. Most role-playing games aren't played that way. So,
and balance brings me nicely onto something I was going to ask you about, which was
I don't believe in balance, so.
Well, you're preaching to the choir there, don't worry about that.
Yeah.
But I think the this, I'm assuming this must be the question you get asked most about Frostgrave, which is to do with the use of the D20.
The D20, the swingy
D20. Combat. So, and even the first time I read it, I think, to be completely honest with you, if I'm reading any game, I can't help but think how I would change it. Like, I have to try and turn that bit of my brain off so when I'm actually reading a game and I want to actually play the game. But I'll be looking through it and I'll think, okay, well, this could probably be simplified. And I think, okay, well, you could probably get rid of this rule here. So looking through Frostgrave, I got to the bit with the D20 and I was like, okay, so you're rolling a D20. And then I look at the ability scores, sort of like your fight score might be +2 for a pretty good soldier. I'm like, okay, +2 on a D20. And I think lots of people get to that point and they think, oh, well, that's badly designed because it means that it's like they're thinking of it for the first time. Like, well, I'm a genius. I've noticed this error here. But I think as I sort of read through the entire game and I sort of looked at some of the examples of some gameplay videos and some of your posts about the game, it really made sense. That without you can correct me here, but my understanding is I think there's a sort of it's not really a dichotomy, but the balance between that sort of strategic balance where it's like chess and this piece always beats this. That's not how chess works, but Stratego, like where a piece always beats another piece, where you have sort of ultimate strategy, and then on the other side you've got complete randomness where your king can die to a stray arrow. And it seems like Frostgrave is deliberately not quite going to total randomness, but it's embracing the sort of the chaos. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think there's two things there. One is that combat, which is where most people are claiming the swinginess, is a lot more statistically complicated than people realize at first. Because while it's true that, like, your best fighter has +4 and your kind of middle fighter has +2. So yeah, he's only got a +2 relative. There's more at work than just that +2. Combat is a function of basically your fight skill, your armor, and your health. And you really have to factor in all three to fully understand a combat. So for example, If you have your thug fighting your knight and your thug has got that +2 and your knight's got that +4, your thug has only this teeny chance of actually killing the knight outright in one blow, whereas the knight actually has a pretty solid chance of just hacking that thug down. So what you get is a situation where any given round of combat is quite random. Yeah. You know, the thug might win, the knight might win. But what becomes apparent as you play is the thug may win the round of combat, but he's still probably going to lose the actual fight because he's probably going to win that round of combat, wound the knight, and then he may do that twice, but then the knight is going to come back and just slaughter him. So it's a lot more complicated than people realize at first. That said, I am very much a believer in chaos, in gaming, and especially in wargaming, partly because, I mean, first off, everybody's like, I don't like swinginess, but of course it's not true because we play games with dice. Therefore, we inherently like some level of randomization, you know, otherwise we'd play diceless games. And what I've found is that by increasing the level of randomness from what is perhaps common in wargaming at the moment, you get a lot more memorable moments. You get a lot more of the moments that you're going to talk about after the game and you're going to talk about next week. And you get a lot more of those moments that really form the narrative in your head. So, you know, maybe your thug does manage to beat that knight for a round, which gives him the moment to kind of push the knight off and make a run for it and escape, you know, or push him off just long enough that the wizard can then get a spell in that blasts the knight across the table or something that. And for me, that's where the fun lies. You know, I want moments that make me laugh because laughing's the fun. And I want things that promote the storytelling in the game and the D20. The D20 comes about from a lot of things. One, I wanted a connection between Frostgrave and Dungeons and Dragons. And that's the kind of the easiest thing to do because the D20 is so associated with D&D. But I also needed a lot of possible results for the combat system, because it does involve so many different statistics. There needed to be a lot of variation in there for it to even work. Mm. And yeah, and then also it allows you to roll the 20 critical hit, you know, which just...
Yeah, that's it. I think it's impossible to ignore the appeal of rolling a 20. I think even if... So like that, none of my games have critical hits on a 20, I don't think, because that's just... It didn't work for the sort of system I was making. But but I think you've got to have... having. If you just say... Oh, that's, you know, I don't want to have that because it's swingy and it's bad design. And, oh, it means that a goblin can shoot me with an arrow and one-shot the player. And fair enough, you might not want that specific type of randomness, but I think that the thing that gets people excited is that small chance of something wild happening is powerful. And
it is.
If you go too far in the other direction, it might be kind of satisfying in the same way that, like I said, in the same way that playing chess is satisfying if you're good at it.
And interestingly, it also promotes balance in the game. It seems counterintuitive, but if you think about it this way, if you're playing chess, well, say when the grandmasters play chess, if a grandmaster loses, goes down a knight, the game's over. He knows the game's over.
Yeah.
Because the game is so well balanced that as soon as one side has a slight advantage, the game's over. It's just a cascade. Mm. Whereas the more randomness you have, the more uneven you can make the game and still give the person with the lesser side a chance of winning.
Yeah, definitely.
Or at least a chance of coming back and making it interesting. Mm.
I think it's easy when you get into sort of game design. I think this is going to sound, I'm just going to say it. It's going to sound really arrogant of me to say this, but I'm going to say that. But I feel like I see a lot of game designers going through a phase of they learn about bell curves and like probability distribution and then all of a sudden the bell curve becomes this holy pinnacle of game design where if you ever see somebody post sort of in a like a game design forum or something with like a game and it uses like flat distribution like just a d20 or like a d6 or something, somebody will chip in to say, oh, but well, if you used 2d4 you'd have a nice little curve on your probability. And I sometimes wonder, like, I understand the purpose of having that curve distribution where your results are weighted towards the middle, and it works for some things. So like I use that for ability scores. I still use, I'm not going to for a minute claim to have invented this, but 3d6 for ability scores. I think that works for me because it means you do still get some extreme results, but generally you're getting weighted towards the middle. But then when it comes to the actual action, I am quite a firm believer that having that push towards the middle, it's like you say, it almost makes it too balanced and it becomes too much a case of as soon as one side is behind, they're a little bit stuck. I think the swinginess is something that everybody should learn to embrace for the right purposes, definitely.
The other thing I think people forget about bell curves is that if you have a lot of modifiers on a bell curve, it really makes a mess because, you know, if you were already slightly below average and you're taking a -4 on a 3d6, you know, all of a sudden the roll becomes almost impossible.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas someone who had a high score, that doesn't really affect the probability that much, you know, and you get, so what seemed like a nice smooth distribution becomes actually really kind of strange and lumpy.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, whereas if you use a d20 and everything's, you know, just kind of a straight roll, then yeah, everything's 5%. It's really easy to understand that and know what you're doing with modifiers whenever you do them.
So one thing I'm asking people about in this series, so the sort of concept of this series is Niche Explorer. So we're sort of looking at like trying to really hone in on how everybody engages in the hobby in maybe a slightly different way. So it's a slightly strange question, but is the way that you play Frostgrave, for instance, or any of your own games, is the way that you play them different to how you think other people play them?
I think interestingly, so I think I played other war games in the style that became Frostgrave. That's not to say it was unique to me, but you know, like I played Warhammer or Mordheim or, you know, any of the others in this kind of very role play. I'm less concerned with the actual objectives of the scenario than I am having a good time and making sure my characters do what my characters would do, and making twangy noises whenever the bow fires. And so I think I wrote Frostgrave, and I think for whatever reason that really came through in the game, and thus the community that formed around it. The community that formed Frostgrave were the people that were looking for that type of game, for a much more, I guess, beer and pretzels, if you want, style miniature game that was really about, you know, making fireball noises more than it was min-maxing your character. I used to be perhaps a little more unusual because there wasn't the game catering for that style out there that would kind of open it up and make other players feel welcome to play it that style. So I guess the thing is everything that is kind of my unique way of playing things then becomes my games. So then I started kind of experimenting with, I wonder if I can do Frostgrave solo or cooperatively, and how can I make it more role player? And that eventually becomes Rangers. And so, again, the way I play it becomes a new game.
So it's basically making the game that you want for yourself.
Yeah, essentially. I think that's probably the only way to keep enjoying.
Yeah, 100%.
Especially.
Yeah, it's definitely what I keep telling myself, and I think it's easy for the sort of the independent designer to say that, because I understand that.
Yeah.
Whoever's working on, say, the next edition of Warhammer 40K, probably can't just say, "Well, no, I think we should really strip back these rules, and we should really make it a lot more." It's probably not going to fly with like the 5-year plan they have for financials. I think that's, as a designer, I think that's the only way to do it. So one thing that I wanted to ask was that, like I say, obviously the idea of this series is that we are going to look at different niches, but I want to at least see if there's anything that the people who are perhaps going to be listening to this podcast are perhaps more going to be role-playing gamers. Is there anything that you think role-playing games or role-playing game players can take from war games or war gamers, if you like?
You know, I've never thought about that question before.
I mean, it is tricky because the line is so blurry.
Yeah, I've always considered myself, neither one nor the other. So it's kind of like...
Yeah, or maybe a better way to look at it is like, what do war games have to offer that role-playing games might not be giving that person? That's interesting to me particularly because I've... I will let you actually answer the question, sorry, but just a slide of damage. I've sort of come from a wargaming background sort of in my very early steps into the hobby, and then sort of moving into role-playing games. And I really never thought I'd go back to war games. And I've been sort of dipping back in over the last few months.
Yeah. I wonder if you're not better actually positioned to answer that question than I am because of the direction you come.
Yeah.
Whereas I come from the other direction, starting with role-playing and going into war games. So it's always been kind of a push in that direction. Hey, here's wargaming, how can it be more like what I used to do?
Well, I think that the sort of my personal like journey here was literally just that it was May this year, and there was obviously the lockdown, so I was stuck inside, and it was my birthday in May, and my partner's family, her sister, was like, what should I get Chris for his birthday? So I ended up with like a voucher, which is great because I love being able to treat myself to something that I wouldn't actually want to spend money on. So I had like a voucher for an online shop, and I thought, you know what, I always fancy trying to, paint some miniatures. I'm stuck inside. I've got nothing to do in the evenings. I'll buy a little pack of miniatures and some paints, and I'll just do some painting like the old days. And and obviously, down the rabbit hole I went, and I was like, well, maybe I'll get a little bit of terrain to it so I can just like play a little skirmish game. Yeah. And then I was like, well, maybe I'll buy two unit kits and I'll kit bash them together. And then, and then next thing I know, I'm diving deep into things again. Right. And I think what made it appeal to me is when I run role-playing games, I don't use miniatures at all. I don't really like to use like a battle mat even. I will occasionally sketch out something if it's really relevant that people know like the exact positioning, but if it's just like you're in a sewer, I just use theater of the mind. It's very loose. because I want people to be imagining what they're doing. So I think the fact that I don't use that physical side of things at all in my role-playing games means that going back into miniature games where that is a huge part of it, I mean, I would almost say it's like the main appeal for me. I think if I was just playing with cubes, I would have lost interest pretty quickly. No matter how well described those cubes are, I think I would have quickly lost interest. Yeah. I think just having some sort of character there and some sort of ownership over what you've made is really appealing to me. But it's strange that I still feel like there's this wall here. Like if I was running a role-playing game, I still wouldn't use miniatures. I still wouldn't want people to be sat there looking at their little miniature they're painted, because I don't know, maybe I need to let that go. Maybe I need to try something in the middle.
I think it's probably the style of role-playing you want to play. Miniatures work better for some than others. I mean, you know, it goes back to the kind of the dungeon dive. Everything's a very fixed area anyway. It does help to have miniatures.
Yeah,
but if you're kind of playing in big urban spaces where you couldn't represent it on the table anyway. I think you're onto something really, that it's what more gaming has that role-playing only has to a much more minor extent is a very tactile element to it, you know, and it, while role-playing has plenty you can do kind of between games in terms of, you know, reading mostly, or, you know, sketching out scenarios or monsters or something like that, I agree with you that most of wargaming takes place on your own. And that's either, you know, painting miniatures, making terrain, or creating army lists, or, you know, creating a new wizard for Frostgrave.
Yeah.
And I do think that sometimes I think about my job and I think all I'm really doing is making excuses for people to buy stuff. You know, when I wrote Frostgrave, it really was because I had already bought all this stuff, like all these Reaper miniatures and stuff. And I was like, man, I don't have anything to do with these, because I don't, at the time I wasn't role-playing. And even if I was, I wouldn't use all these miniatures. Mm. So what can I do with them? So I wrote Frostgrave to give me an excuse to, especially all these wizard figures I'd painted over the years that never saw any use at all. And I think, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I think sometimes people need that excuse. All right, I bought Frostgrave. What cool stuff does this give me permission to go out and
buy?
And paint, you know, and, you know, because painting is actually a wonderful hobby, and that avoiding certain companies perhaps, but it's not a very expensive hobby. One miniature may seem expensive, but then if you spend a couple hours painting it, you know, you've actually got a pretty good investment for your time. And once you get to a decent level of artistry, I suppose, or craft, it becomes quite therapeutic. Kind of as you were talking about during the lockdown. I mean, I've always used it almost as a form of meditation.
Yeah, sure.
And it also becomes a really good, for me, time to imagine and create. So if I'm painting a miniature, you know, I may think about what character is this miniature, and that character could become something in my game, or could become a bad guy in the game or something. Or, you know, what item is this character holding? Is that a cool magic item? Should I invent rules for that? And so there's a real connection between the physical and the creative that I think can be really,
I think, helpful. The skirmish format especially really supports that, because I've got you'd be pleased to know I did buy some Frostgrave miniatures. I think literally while we've been recording this, I've heard my doorbell go downstairs, so I'm hoping they've actually arrived today. I've got the new wizard set and the new soldier set. And I will be using it to make a Frostgrave warband, but I will also be raiding it for bits to build other just random kitbashes with some other miniatures. And I think that when I go into the whole modeling and painting process now, I go into it completely differently than I did when I was collecting Warhammer Fantasy Battles or Warhammer 40K when I was like 11, 12 years old. I think back then, it always felt like there was a lot of pressure to, so for instance, I had a small Eldar army, and I still remember being really stressed at painting like the Eldar Guardians. I had like, I don't know, 15 Guardians or whatever, and I really wanted them all to look exactly the same, because that's how they always looked in the White Dwarf magazines and stuff. Like they were all very uniform. And it's all great to begin with, but then when you, I don't know if this is just me having a low attention span, by the time I get to sort of 5, 6, 7 of the same miniature and I'm waiting for the next coat to dry, it does suck a little bit of the joy out of it for me. So I think with things like Frostgrave, when you've got like the freedom of, say, all you know is that you've got a thug and you can use whatever miniature you've got, or you can just bash some stuff together. And if they look like a bit of a thug, you can say they're a thug. Or if they've got a shield, you can call them a man-at-arms or whatever.
Exactly. And then going back to that kind of balance thing, I want you to be able to pull out that miniature and go, you know what? Actually, this would look really cool with a shield on it.
Yeah.
So you just put a shield on it because, you know, yes, it has a minor in-game effect, but you know it's not huge. So whether it's kind of a plus or a negative, you don't care because, frankly, it's making your character look cooler.
Yeah, definitely. So. And the... Same with the inclusion of the monsters in there. I think that's something that also appeals to role-playing gamers, perhaps, in that they can use all these monsters that they've tried to use in role-playing games, and either the players haven't gone in that direction, or the players have killed it before they've even had a chance to put it on the table. I think just having an excuse to bring all those old monsters out.
It's funny because you look at a company like Reaper, and I love Reaper. Yeah, I love painting Reapers. I love buying Reapers. But the thing is, if you're role-playing, you buy like a Grell figure or something. How many times in your life are you going to use that figure?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? You're going to run one campaign. They're going to fight it once. They're going to kill it. And you're never going to have a Grell again. You know?
Exactly.
So in a war game, it actually works. It's a better excuse to buy the miniatures because you can think, oh, I could roll that Grell anytime.
Yeah, that's it. And it becomes a thematic thing where if you've only got, even if you've got a very small selection, I quite like the idea of, obviously there are like, there's like random wandering monster tables in Frostgrave. But right. I think if I were running Frostgrave today, I would look at that and I would think, I've actually got a very small selection of miniatures, to be honest. I would think, well, yeah. I haven't really got anything I can use for, I don't know, a Yeti and a snow leopard or whatever. Yeah. So I think, I really hope that people are making their own wandering monster tables with the things that they've got. So all of a sudden, that gelatinous cube suddenly has like a 1 in 6 chance of coming out, and their version of Felstad is slightly different because it's just based on what they've got, and that really appeals to me, that idea.
Yeah, which is something I wrote in the second edition, which I didn't run it in the first, because when I put it in the first, it was just one of those things that to me was obvious, you know, because that's the style of game I play. But I didn't realize actually that's maybe not obvious to everyone else because they've just never played that way.
Yeah, so. it's really strange. I think I think some people just really do need to be given that permission to do it, and it might seem strange if you spent your whole life doing it, but I think there's a pattern I've noticed when I speak to a lot of people who make their own games, and this might just be complete like selection bias with the people I've spoken to. But you mentioned about trying to run D&D from the bits and pieces that you understood, or if you had a sort of an incomplete version. So I had an incomplete version of HeroQuest when I was very young. the board game HeroQuest, and it was missing some of the key parts of it, but me and my friend really wanted to play it, so we would just make up rules like that felt right. And I almost think everybody should try and run a game that's missing a few bits at some point in their lives. If they're at all interested in game design, they should just get like a version of, I don't know, maybe not a sort of very finely tuned board game, but something like a role-playing game. Well, to be honest, even something like Frostgrave, say.
Yeah, get Frostgrave and tear a few pages out.
tear it in half and give one half to one person, one half to the other person. and you can then see how they fill the gaps. And I think it's just really good. It really opened your mind to how you can approach these games.
It may just be that, like, you know, I've spent a lot of my life thinking about creativity because I'm just fascinated by it. But for some reason, we don't have this idea that creativity is a skill. You know, we all accept that skills are things that you can practice and develop and get better at. And as I've gotten older, I've come to realize creativity is that as well.
Yeah.
Whereas we kind of, as a society, idolize creativity as being something that you just have, you know.
Definitely.
He's just, Stephen King, he can just come up with a new plot line whenever he wants or whatever, you know. But no, I mean, he sits there and he works at it and he practices and, you know, obviously you do it long enough and you get better at it. And so I think those people that started with their incomplete sets and had to start designing rules early, you know, they've just practiced more.
I always look at like illustrators like with a lot of envy because I really wish I could like create these visual representations of what's in my head, but I'm really bad at drawing. And I think I always used to say to like artists, I'd say, oh, I really wish I could draw. And then I can't remember who I was talking to, but somebody said something like, well, that, do you know how many times people say that to me? And they say, oh, you're so talented and you're so brilliant. I really wish I had that talent. And what they're thinking is, well, actually, I worked really hard to get really good at this. And I think it's you're right. It's often idolized as like this mystical thing.
I get that one with writing a lot, I guess, because, you know, anybody who comes through a decent education can write, you know, but there's a big difference between having the ability to write and really being a writer. And the difference is probably about a million words.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Found it out on a typewriter or a computer or with a pencil. So
that's it. In terms of like how people, I mean, speaking of sort of hoping that people get like incomplete rule sets and making their own version of it, the sad truth nowadays is that people can probably just like download a PDF of the rules. But is there anything that you've seen people doing with one of your games that's really surprised you in terms of how they've either how they changed it or how they've interpreted it differently?
So a lot of people have done, you know, kind of Frostgrave scenarios or Rangers of Shadowdeep scenarios, a lot of fan content. And I try to encourage that as much as possible. But I also try to avoid reading it. And that's very specifically because I don't want to be hugely influenced by it.
Sure.
You know, obviously I don't want to copy what someone else has done, but also, you know, I feel like I'm on my own path on these games and I want to stay there, you know.
Yeah.
It's not to say I don't listen to what the fans want. I try to, but I also, you know, very much have my own ideas for what I want to do and want to take it that way. But, you know, a lot of people, especially with Frostgrave, and because it's a war game, and a lot of people just don't want to cover all their stuff with snow. There's a lot of interesting setting changes.
Yeah.
Probably the most interesting one I've seen is that there's a guy who runs a lot of games. In fact, he says he runs them basically as a role-playing game, but it's set in like kind of a steampunk Elizabethan era.
Okay.
And he does some amazing tables and set up with that, you know, and I love it, but it's also like, I have no personal interest in developing that kind of idea as a setting, but I'm glad that it's given him the impetus to do that.
It's really interesting that you say about not wanting to look at other people's content, because I was sort of nodding along like, yeah, that's a really good idea. And funnily enough, tonight I am doing a stream where I'm looking through, somebody did a game jam for games inspired by Electric Bastion Land. And tonight I'm going to be reading through 62 fan-made games. So I'm kind of like, I'm doing the full immersion of the opposite of what you just said. So hopefully that won't completely drive me mad with ideas.
I'd hate to be number like 57, you know.
Oh, it's going to be a very brief tour. Don't worry. It's going to be a quick glance and more just to show people what people have made.
Yeah.
Well, I want to say thank you, first of all,
no
for coming on. It's been great. And, if people want to find out more about you and your games, where can they find out more?
So I've got a blog called The Renaissance Troll, which is just therenaissancetroll.blogspot.com, where it's both a hobby blog. So I post all the miniatures I'm painting and just what I'm thinking about and reading. But I also post kind of all the big updates for my games. You can follow me on Facebook or befriend me on Facebook. I mainly use that as a kind of extension of quote work. So don't be shy about friending me. And all of my games, Ranger Shadowdeep, Frostgrave, Oathmark, all have Facebook pages devoted to them with quite a few people doing lots of cool stuff. So if you like to look at miniatures and see what other people are doing, then you definitely want to jump on there. But
awesome.
So those are the main places.
Great. And if anyone listening that is sort of is still thinking, well, I'm still very much a role-playing gamer, I'm not necessarily going to jump into war games, I'd still say, if you do check out the blog, Renaissance Troll, there's lots of stuff in there that's very useful, I think, for role-playing games as well. I think there's a lot of transferable thought on there that is worth checking out.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks for that. And thank you to everyone for listening and to everybody that supports this podcast on Patreon. As always, you can stay up to date at bastionland.com. and be sure to join me next week where I'll be exploring another niche in tabletop gaming. Bye for now.